In the KSRO kitchen, I'm Steve Carter, along with Chef John Ash and special guest Jonathan Kaufman. Before we meet Jonathan, John, we're going to give away a pair of tickets to the Artisan Cheese Festival. Is that okay?
It is.
I mean, I think you'll
probably... I thought they were for me.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, you're not entitled to win these tickets. So the Artisan Cheese Festival is coming up to the Sonoma County Fairgrounds the weekend of March 23rd.
Sonoma County's most accurate, dependable forecast with KSRO's Daniel Trucios.
May see showers today. Today, cloudy at 64 degrees, 56 on the coast. Few clouds tonight, low 44, 47 on the shores. Mostly cloudy, but dry for tomorrow at 70 degrees, 64 in Bodega Bay. Monday, some showers at 65, 60 on the coastline. Depend on weather every 30 minutes on FM News Talk 103.5 and 94.5. KSRO.
Okay, I was rudely interrupted by the commercials. Sorry to hear. That's okay, though. We have a pair of tickets to give away to the 12th Annual California Artisan Cheese Festival at the Sonoma County Fairgrounds Event Center. And this is for the big artisan cheese tasting and marketplace. Two tickets at the Hall of Flowers in Sonoma County. How about that? We've been to that for the last 11 years.
Yeah.
It's quite an event.
It's a great event. It's gotten bigger each year, and it's going to be really big this year.
Tickets are $50 each, but we will take caller. We know, why don't we have Jonathan choose his favorite number today between 1 and 10. Jonathan, your favorite number?
8.
Caller number 8 at 636-1350 will win this pair of tickets to Sunday, March 25th, California Artisan Cheese Festival Marketplace. That's caller number 8 at 636-1350. And now we have some very special introductory music for Jonathan, okay? Should we do that? I had to choose some appropriate music to introduce Jonathan Kaufman.
It's good.
And you remember that probably from the 60s. You were a tyke, but you probably remember.
Well, I also remember the Nike commercial later that co-opted
it. Oh, that's right. They co-opted that. Jonathan's new book is called Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash in the KSRO Kitchen. First of all, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
I have been reading you for years as a restaurant critic and reviewer, starting in the East Bay. A family lived in Alameda, and that's when I first started reading you, and then your name popped up in the San Francisco Chronicle, and you've been writing great restaurant reviews and pieces for the Chronicle for many years. You're, I must tell you, a terrific talent, and I enjoy your work a great deal.
Thank you.
And your humor certainly comes through, not only your scholarship, but your humor comes through in this book, too. It's not a tirade about why you should or shouldn't eat certain foods. It's really a journalist's look at how we came to be eating many of the foods that were popularized in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
I think what was so fascinating about it is the memories it brings back, because both Steve and I are kind of that generation who have fond memories of food and people, and especially a lot of the names that I've sort of forgotten about that you reminded me of. It's like, oh, yeah. I made Adele Davis's first, that was my first bread that I ever made. You know?
So you have a fascinating background. Tell us about it.
So I grew up, I didn't grow up with hippies. I grew up in a liberal Mennonite community in a small town in Indiana.
It's called Elkhart.
It's called Elkhart, Indiana. Yeah,
and I know Elkhart because I went to IU in Bloomington, Indiana.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So I know Elkhart. Yeah. So you grew up eating vegetarian food predominantly?
Not necessarily vegetarian. Mennonites of my parents' generation were kind of the first off of the farm and first out of rural areas. They were living in the small community, but which has a really strong Mennonite community, but they were some of the first to go to college as well. And so I never really connected what we were eating when I was a kid with this larger movement that's associated with San Francisco and the counterculture until I was a little bit older. But we were having, you know, tofu stir fries and lentil stews and ground nut stew with chicken and whole wheat bread. And that was really based on a Mennonite cookbook that came out in 1976 called More with Less, but which was really based on and really inspired by the 1971 Diet for a Small Planet.
Oh. just remarkable. Mm-hmm. So you approach this very affectionately, not tongue-in-cheek, not ironically. You ate this food, you loved this food then, and you still love a lot of this food now. It's not like, thank God we got over that period.
Right. Although, I mean, I do have some complicated memories of some of the things. You know, like carob was just one of those things that I will never forgive anybody for feeding me as a child. But
and it's still around.
And it's still around. Yeah.
You can still have it.
But some of your favorite foods, do you still cook?
Oh, definitely. I cook vegetarian on weekdays, and we mostly cook vegetarian at home. But I think, you know, there's nothing sort of resets my system like a tofu stir fry over brown rice.
Well, it's wonderful. This gives a historical viewpoint. It's mm-hmm. so funny when you live through something, sometimes you're not able to reflect on how you got to where you are until you read something in
really
a book like
true.
This.
It's really true. You know, there are even things that I was in the middle of, and I didn't even know what was going on. You know, you just took it for granted that this is the thing that, especially living in San Francisco, you know, that this is the thing that everybody did, you mm-hmm. know, but
which
it wasn't true.
Which we both did in the 60s and 70s, too, and you brought up a lot of wonderful memories of some of the first natural foods restaurants in San Francisco, too. Mm-hmm. Give us a timeline of how we got, that's a big question, but starting, let's say, back in the 40s with Rodale and how that moved into the 50s in Southern California, which was really kind of new to me, not growing up in that part of the world, how important some landmark restaurants and natural food stores that started in the 1950s. Let's take the 40s and 50s first.
So, I mean, when I started researching the book, I just assumed that the counterculture invented everything. And what was the most important, what was fascinating was to encounter all the movements that existed in America before that really shaped the counterculture diet or, you know, this hippie food diet. And a couple of those would be, one of the most important ones was the health food. I wouldn't call it a movement necessarily, but there were all these tiny health food stores all over the country, but they were really clustered around Southern California, where a lot of the nutritional gurus were based. And that was, you know, that you'd find these little, you know, vitamin shops that would have some whole wheat snacks and then all of these ingredients that the health food movement considered superfoods, like wheat germ and brewer's yeast and yogurt and molasses, things that were really kind of fringe for most of America, but were these, you know, they were supposed to be these foods that you would add to anything you ate to power them up with nutrition. Mm-hmm. And the other movement that kind of preceded the counterculture movement, but just by a decade, was macrobiotics. And macrobiotics arrived in New York in 1960, founded by a Japanese man named George Osawa, who brought his dietary philosophy that was a little bit, it was sort of half spiritual practice, half dietary practice, around the idea of balancing yin and yang in our diet. And the way that he advocated doing that was through basically a Japanese peasant diet. And so he was teaching all of these Americans who were concerned about health, not just that, you know, he was kind of the first he was coming out with the idea that, you know, the American diet was causing heart disease and obesity and possibly even cancer at a time when, you know, American nutritionists weren't really even going there. And he advocated for eating locally and seasonally and organically. But at the same time, like, his ideas about yin and yang were a little very different from traditional Chinese ideas and a little off base. And he had this theory that if you ate, you know, nothing but brown rice for 10 days, you could cure your body of all of these diseases. Mm-hmm. So you had counterculture kids who were interested in cooking with whole grains and interested in ideas like eating locally and seasonally and organically were really gravitating to macrobiotics. But they were taking it too far. And so there were a number of early cases of scurvy and one or two people who died.
Well, because the diet was so severe.
Right.
I mean, it was not, it made no sense at all. And he was kind of a, would you call him a guru of sorts?
He was. I mean,
because he lectured a lot and traveled around the country.
Yeah. And you know, he sort of sold his diet as this way of, you weren't just bringing your body into, in, you know, tune with the universe, but your sort of spirit. So people did approach it with a certain amount of I wouldn't call it a cult, but I would definitely call it sort of a religious reverence.
So can you, it's kind of a long story, but can you talk a little bit about Chico, California and brown rice and how that, because that was the macrobiotic deal. And why did Chico become so important?
And that was in that chapter, the brown rice and the macrobiotic pioneers.
Yeah. So when George Isawa arrives in New York in 1960, and he gathers a group of artists and intellectuals around him who are interested in his diet. And a few years in, he starts talking to them about getting out of New York, because this was right before the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so there was a lot of concern about nuclear fallout. So a group of New Yorkers scoured maps of the United States to look at like winds and terrain. And they were trying to find the area that would be the most free of nuclear fallout. And they settled on Chico, California. Not just because it was sort of in this like, you know, bucolic, you know, one area, but because it was a rice growing area, and they were obsessed with brown rice. So 34, 35 of them set out and took this cross-country trip, and it was covered by national newspapers because one of the people in the group had been a very popular soap opera actress, and she quit her job like to join the macrobiotic, you know, pilgrimage to California. And so it was a pretty big deal.
I think it was Search for Tomorrow or something, one of those soap operas. And how did the Lundberg rice-growing family feed into this?
So when they settled into Chico, they were trying to find ways to make money. And one of the ways they found was to make rice cakes, which George Isawa had sent them a machine over from Japan.
So were they the first to do that?
In
America. Where they came from.
That's where they came from.
Okay.
But they really wanted a source of organic brown rice. And it wasn't until 1970 around that they looked at all these farmers, talked to all these farmers, and nobody wanted to take the risk of growing organically because they didn't want to, you know, risk the family business. And the Lundberg family, four brothers, had been trying to grow a little bit more with fewer pesticides, fewer fertilizers, and they bought in, and that's how they converted to organic production.
And so the company that was formed was called, which is still around, I guess, is it? Chico-San?
Oh, Chico-San was the rice cake company.
Yeah.
They're not around.
Yeah.
They sold out. But the Lundberg Family Farms, man, they made their millions on organic brown rice.
Yeah. And they have extended that product line. There's all kinds of flavored rice cakes now.
Yeah.
I mean, the jalapeno and you name it. And you wrote one of the funniest lines I've ever read in a book, and that is, those rice cakes seem to radiate anti-calories. That was your line, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Didn't it seem like that even though you put about 800 calories worth of peanut butter on that rice cake, somehow it negated it, didn't it? That was a remarkable chapter. You divide the book into three different eras. Would you talk about how you came to that?
Yeah. So the first era was the era that I've just been talking about, actually, the sort of the sources, the source material for the counterculture diet. The second era I would call kind of the revolutionary period, when I think the counterculture was kind of had these, they were feeling disillusioned and fearful and angry and upset about the war. And so they knew that they had to, you know, change their diet some way. That was one of the ways they were going to sort of change the world around them. Mm-hmm. And so they rejected all of these ideas, rejected all these processed foods, and then, you know, tried to adopt all these whole grains and then figure out how to cook them by sort of taking up the lessons of macrobiotics and other folks. And then starting around the 1974, 75, as the Vietnam War was ending, then they started extending this diet and bringing it to the rest of America. And a big way that they did that was through food co-ops.
And we all had, many of us had experiences with co-ops successful, but eventually most of them did implode. There was infighting. There was the harsh reality of making a living and also covering overheads. And unfortunately, the terrible word business started to encroach of like, oh, this is a business. We don't want it to be, but it has to be if it's going to survive. And there's a great chapter about co-ops and pooled resource buying.
So so there were these characters, people that whose names are familiar to me, but who were also involved in those. One of those was Paul Hawken,
Yeah.
So he was involved on the East Coast in creating part of a brand which is still around, Erewhon,
right.
To do things. Can you talk a little bit about him?
Yeah, before he started Smith & Hawken and became sort of an environmental activist and thought leader, he was just a guy who held light shows in San Francisco, and he got interested in macrobiotics. There was a small group of San Franciscans who did back in the late 1960s, and like many of them, he ended up in Boston, where one of George Osawa's main disciples, Michio Kushi, mm-hmm. Michio and Aveline Kushi, mm-hmm. They sort of created this community around their teachings, and Aveline Kushi set up a small business called Erewhon that was going to, you know, sell brown rice and miso and tamari and all of these foods that you couldn't find anywhere else, and Paul Hawken took it over, and he really expanded its reach, and he led a group of macrobiotic followers that turned it into a multi-million dollar.
It was quite remarkable. I went to school in Boston in the early 70s, and it was within walking distance to Erewhon food store. And I also went to classes that Aveline taught on macrobiotic cooking, and heard Michio lecture very frequently. And of course, the joke that everyone said was that if you spell it backwards, it spells nowhere if you reverse the H and the W. It was a very vibrant food scene in Boston because of Michio Kushi.
Yeah.
And everyone was exploring yin and yang. Everyone was saying, is this, maybe my health is compromised because I'm too yin. Maybe I need more yang. Mm. It sounds airy-fairy at this point, but we were really looking deeply into improving our health and looking for guidance, and Michio and Aveline provided that.
So all the way through the book, though, you talk about how many of those principles, I guess, or thoughts, they're still with us.
Oh,
I
definitely.
Mean, we are ingrained with the whole idea of yin and yang and all of that still to this day.
Well, and just as, I mean, macrobiotics is fascinating to me in the big picture because, I mean, so much of what they were talking about is really so much of the way that we're talking about food, about, you know, locally, organically, and seasonally, and just the idea of food as medicine, listening to what your body says, you know, to you about what you should be eating. It was in the sort of, in the particulars around yin and yang that it gets a little ludicrous to me.
We'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll dive into the chapters. We've given you a big, broad overview of the new book by Jonathan Kaufman. It's called Hippie Food. It's How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. Perhaps one of you listening falls into one of those categories or knew somebody that fell into one of those, or you're still in that category. Good for you. If you'd like to chat with Jonathan, you have that opportunity during this hour. He's in the studio with John Ash and me. You can call us at 636-1350. Share your thoughts or memories, if you remember them, from that time in the 60s and 70s, things that changed for you in the...
That was a fun comment, if you remember them.
about how your lifestyle and food choices change and the awareness that happened to so many of us during this very vibrant time in America. Wonderful book, 636-1350, if you'd like to chat with Jonathan Kaufman. This is the KSRO Good Food Hour.
Weather every 10 minutes mornings, every 30 minutes all the time on FM News Talk Radio, 103.5 FM and 94.5 FM. KSRO.
The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's fun to shop healthy. Your food is fresh and provided by local farmers and ranchers. These farmers offer the freshest local produce and select beef, pork, lamb, chicken, seafood, and freshly made sausage. A variety of cheeses, eggs, and dairy, all at the market. In March, the farmers bring fresh salad mix. Parsons Homegrown is back with delicious organic heirloom tomatoes. Enjoy the Beet Generation's fresh produce and handmade pasta. Shop our creative local artisans and sample warm, fresh pastries and bread. Select one of Dominique's beautiful cherry pies. Enjoy breakfast or lunch from our variety of prepared foods. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, winner of Bohemian's Best of Award, is open year-round, Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 to 1 p.m. at Luther Burbank Center. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun. Smiling was always tough for me, even at my happiest moments, because of my smile. I never knew about cosmetic dentistry, but now my smile is perfect. Thank you, Dr. Sean Wilson.
I know having a beautiful smile makes everyone feel great. Unfortunately, even if you were born with perfect teeth, they may not be so perfect now. Gaps, fillings, stains, chipped, and discolored teeth can all affect appearance, self-confidence, and quality of life. From tooth whitening to implants, my passion is creating your unique and amazing smile that can even make you look younger.
There's only one dentist that's been voted Sonoma County's best dentist 6 years in a row. There's a reason why. Get the smile you've always wanted. Tell your smartphone to call Dr. Sean Wilson, DDS, and schedule your appointment today.
Calling Dr. Sean Wilson, DDS.
What are your business marketing resolutions for 2018? More than one in five small business owners report that their biggest challenge is finding the time to properly market their business. If a major challenge is time and you're not quite sure where to start, mark your calendars. The Digital Marketing Bootcamp Workshop is back, free for business owners and marketers looking to stay on top of trends in the digital space. Join us March 13th and 14th at the Flamingo Resort in Santa Rosa for registration. Visit SonomaMediaGroup.com. That's SonomaMediaGroup.com.
Help local kids discover the love of reading by donating to the United Way Children's Book Drive. Drop off new or gently used English, Spanish, or bilingual books during the month of March at more than 30 locations all over Sonoma County, including all Exchange Bank locations and at United Way of the Wine Country. Join us in getting free books to kids to help them learn to read. Find a full list of drop-off locations at UnitedWayWineCountry.org.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
When the truth is found to be
book-appropriate music today. Hippie food, how back to the landers, long hairs, and revolutionaries changed the way we eat. Jonathan Kaufman has written this book. He's a very well-known food writer and restaurant reviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash in the Chaos Ordo Kitchen. Chapter number one, fruits, seeds, and health nuts. Health is in parentheses, which I love, in Southern California. And you talk about the health nut, which was actually an establishment in Southern California.
The health hut.
I'm sorry, the health hut. And then the Aware Inn were the two. Were the stars that wanted to remain vital and beautiful.
Your stories about the people who were associated with those two places. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about
that? Sure, yeah. So back in 1958, there were these two restaurants that were open. One of them was only open for a couple of years, and one of them stayed open for much longer. But they were interesting to me because their founders ended up really directly influencing the counterculture. And the Health Hut was run by a guy who called himself Gypsy Boots, who was a nature boy, this band of men who had long hair and beards, and they lived in the caves and the trees around LA, and they ate raw food. And so Gypsy Boots, he was just a character. I mean, he'd have these hula nights where, you know, he would have, like, you'd have movie stars and then sort of random folks and all pressed together, and like they'd be eating moon witches, which were like soya sprout sandwiches, and then he'd do like these hula hoops. He was just such a character that Steve Allen ended up inviting him on the show when he had this national talk show. And you know, Gypsy Boots bounded on the stage and was like, "Hello, Steve Allen, I'm going to get you healthy," and made him a smoothie. And he became a regular character on the show.
It was remarkable.
And what was the connection to Nat King Cole? I love that.
Oh, yeah. So one of the Nature Boys, Eden Abes, who was Gypsy's best friend for a time, wrote this song called Nature Boy and slipped the music to Nat King Cole, and it became a national hit.
And it's a beautiful song.
It's
and supposedly
beautiful song.
He wrote this while wandering the beaches of Mexico, shoeless, topless, and this beautiful melody. There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. Nat King Cole does it better than I do. But listen to the song. It's quite a beautiful song. So he was one of the Nature Boys.
Yeah, he was.
So who was Gaylord Houser?
Gaylord Houser was he was a German immigrant who became he was one of the sort of the Southern California nutritional gurus. He had a couple books out. He had a radio talk show, and like many of them, many of the gurus of his time, he also had a line of products that showed up in health stores that are still around, including Swiss Chris, which is a laxative, and Spike soy salt. But he was all about the beauty in food, and so he was kind of a proto Gwyneth Paltrow in the sense that, you know, if you ate this sort of raw, delicious, healthy food, you could grow more beautiful.
I don't know if you know this or not, but do you know what Louis Armstrong attributed to his long career and his health? Swiss Chris.
All right.
He took Swiss Chris laxative, and that was his key to maintaining his vibrant health well into his 60s and 70s.
So in here you talk a little bit about it, and because I've spent some time down there, about Rancho La Puerta.
Yeah.
And you actually revealed more than they reveal when you go down to visit there. The founder of that, I can never say his last name right. I think it looks like Zeliki, but it's not.
I think it's Szeke?
It's something like that. Yeah, it's Hungarian or whatever.
Yeah,
it is.
Edmund Bordeaux Szeke. Yeah,
but he was a nutcase.
He really was. Yeah, he was a Hungarian academic who somehow made his way over to the United States and Mexico in right before World War II. But he claimed to have discovered a lost Essene gospel in the Vatican and then also in a monastery. But the Vatican claims that they have no record of this gospel, and the monastery burned down, so that, you know, there's no way to prove it. But this gospel, the Essene Gospel of Peace, was actually a dietary gospel that recommends raw foods, yogurt, sprouted grain breads baked in the sun, and frequent enemas. So that was the gospel he was teaching at Rancho La Puerta. Mm-hmm.
At Bobby Louis Armstrong.
Well, they still do that.
Talk about the source.
So the source, when I was talking about those two restaurants, the Ware Inn was the other one, and that was a much classier affair. It was organic food, but really continental cuisine. And its owners, Jim and Elaine Baker, were just this sort of glamorous, healthy couple, and they ended up splitting up after Jim Baker killed a couple people in self-defense, and he went on this great spiritual quest that took him became a disciple of Yogi Bhajan in LA, and he opened a restaurant called The Source, and its diet was based on Edmund Bordeaux Szeke's writings, but it was raw foods, lots of juices. But then he became a bit of a cult leader, and he had 250 young people in the Source family who lived with him in a big mansion, and they all dressed in white with long flowing hair, and they're beautiful. And they ran this restaurant, and it was incredibly successful, and it allowed them to form a rock band. And he had 14 wives at one point. And then he died in a sort of a freak hang gliding accident.
I learned something fascinating about the connection to a Woody Allen movie in your book.
Yeah, Woody Allen set a scene in Annie Hall at The Source where, you know, he goes and orders a plate of mashed yeast, which they did not serve.
They did not, but what a classic scene that was.
Well, and you talk about The Source that was the place that Steve McQueen and Warren Beatty and, I mean, all of these big name stars went to hang out and rub shoulders and do all of that.
Yeah, when I was talking to former cult members, they had memories of John Lennon and Yes and all of these rock stars.
We covered chapter 2, the brown rice and the macrobiotic pioneers, pretty well with the Lundbergs and that portion of microbiotics. Then we get into the brown bread and the pursuit of wholesomeness. That's a wonderful chapter. What's that chapter about, that number 3? The diggers are introduced in that chapter.
Yeah. And so what was fascinating, you know, about that chapter was I started looking at the deep roots of the health food movement and our ideas about healthy eating. And they really date back to the 1830s with Sylvester Graham, who was a vegetarian proselytizer who advocated for eating whole grain bread. He was kind of the it was the first, America was starting to industrialize its food supply, especially with, you know, industrial milling. And he was the first person to critique this bread as being not nutritious enough. And so he wanted people to make bread at home, and it should be this coarse brown flour. And so his ideas kind of lingered on through the Seventh-day Adventists, who kind of picked up his vegetarianism and as well as some of his other ideas. And it kind of, you know, sort of burbled along in the American consciousness until the counterculture really wanted to reject processed food and plastic bread and, you know, and embrace whole grains. And so they were carrying on this long tradition.
You mentioned also Edward Espy Brown in this chapter, the Tassajara cookbook, how important that one was. But I think you credit maybe Adele Davis with being one of the most influential conduits between that generation and the quote hippie generation.
Yeah. Adele Davis was a nutritionist who was really kind of big between the 1940s and in the early 1970s. And the nutritional establishment hated her because they said, you know, they kind of, they looked askance at her, some of her methods, and her the way she combined research. But she was big into vitamins, and she was big into, you know, having as many vitamins as possible in the diet. And the way that she also advocated doing that was through natural foods. You know, she would argue that, you know, white bread with white flour that we had enriched, it was like a burglar had raided your house and was giving you back a few of your jewels. You know,
I didn't realize that's the enriching of bread, the adding of things that had been stripped out of it, became such a national cause.
Yeah.
I mean, it became a really big deal. And so there was a law passed.
Yeah.
Enrich bread. Can you talk about that?
Sure. In World War II, you know, they were really concerned by the nutritional, by the diet of Americans. It became kind of acute, their concerns over vitamins and the lack of vitamins in food and nutritional vitamin deficiencies in the 1940s. And so they worked with the Millers Association of America to get them to add vitamins back to milled flour.
Yeah, because it was devoid of any nutrition at that point.
And enrichment is actually a huge success for public health policy because it cured pellagra in the South.
We'll take a break. Jonathan Kaufman is joining John Ash and me today in the KSRO kitchen. If you want to chat with Jonathan, call us. We'll take calls at the bottom of the hour, which is now 636-1350. If you have memories about Back to the Landers, Long Hairs and Revolutionaries, Changing the Way We Eat, that's the subtitle of Jonathan's book, Hippie Food. Call us. We'd love to chat with you, or if you're shy, you can shoot me an email, steve@ksro.com. When we return, we're up to chapter 4, the political dish, tofu.
FM News Talk Radio, North County 103.5, South County 94.5, KSRO.
No one likes to live with the mess and inconvenience of home improvement projects. That's why Milgard makes it so easy for you to replace your old, drafty, hard-to-open windows. Often it takes less than a day to improve the look and value of your home with reliable, energy-efficient Milgard replacement windows. Milgard's dependable delivery means you get the right windows at the right time. And because most jobs use your existing frames and openings, it minimizes the mess. Plus, you don't have to worry about disposing of your old windows. Milgard makes it easy to get home improvement done. Call DJ's Sash and Glass today for Milgard Windows. DJ's can furnish and install a variety of shower door enclosures too. Add a touch of class to your glass with DJ's Sash and Glass. 2985 Wilton Court. Call 546-7344 and online at djsglass.com.
Hi, I'm attorney Noreen Evans. As we rebuild from the destructive October wildfires, nothing is more imperative than holding PG&E accountable. PG&E has suggested that hurricane-strength winds brought down their power lines. However, weather station records show wind speeds were only about half that strength when the lines fell to the ground just before the devastating wildfires. Morrow Archer and Associates and our team of respected local attorneys is now accepting cases from survivors of the Tubbs and Nuns fires. Each week, we hold town hall meetings so you can meet our team, hear the results of our investigation, and understand your rights for compensation. Our next meetings are Thursday, March 15th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. and Saturday the 17th from 9 to 11 a.m. at 70 Stony Point Road in Santa Rosa. Visit pgelawsuit.com or call us at 707-237-2445.
John Cox of the Law Offices of John Cox is the attorney responsible for the content of this commercial.
Hey, it's me, your radio. Yeah, I know, I'm usually here playing your favorite song or the news, weather, sports, talk, even traffic. You and I spend a lot of time together, and I was thinking you should advertise your business right here on the radio. Check it out. About 93% of the population listens to the radio each week. And with radio, you can reach the right people with the right message at the right time, at the right cost. I mean, simply put, the dollars you spend on radio advertising generate the best ROI of any media. I bet you didn't know I knew stuff like that, did you? I know what you're thinking. Sounds pretty good, but I have no idea where to start with this radio advertising thing. Surprise! I'm kind of an expert. Tell you what, give us a call today and find out how radio delivers results.
Find out how radio can help promote your business to thousands of potential customers every week. Call me, Kevin Wadlinger, or go to NorthBayAdvertising.com.
Sonoma County's most accurate, dependable forecast with KSRO's Daniel Trucios.
May see showers today. Today, cloudy at 64 degrees, 56 on the coast. Few clouds tonight, low 44, 47 on the shores. Mostly cloudy, but dry for tomorrow at 70 degrees, 64 in Bodega Bay. Monday, some showers at 65, 60 on the coastline. Depend on weather every 30 minutes on FM News Talk 103.5 and 94.5 KSRO.
What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream. Dreaming about my bundle of joy.
Jonathan Kaufman in the KSRO kitchen today, along with John Ashmy and the Love and Spoonful. The new book is called Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Longhairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. We're up to tofu, the political dish. Before we do that, John,
before
has
we go
something
there,
you've got to say.
Let's, just for a second, talk about Tussahara and Edward Brown and what a change, difference he made, certainly to our part of the world here in Northern California.
Well, Adele Davis aside, there really weren't that many good recipes for whole wheat bread out there. And, you know, it was part of this whole movement. You had all these counterculture kids who wanted to adopt all these new foods, and they had no idea how to cook them because their parents had never cooked them. I mean, people in America had mostly never cooked with them. And so Edward Brown was a Zen monk at Tussahara. He was the first head cook at the monastery when it formed, who had actually learned before the Zen Center had bought Tussahara and turned it into a monastery. He actually spent a summer there cooking and worked with a couple of bakers who had learned how to bake whole wheat bread from this restaurant down in Ojai that's still pretty famous. They taught him how to make this bread, and so he would bake whole wheat bread as part of his, you know, as part of being the head chef at Tussahara, and really realized that there wasn't a good cookbook out there that had a good baking book that taught people the sort of sensory elements of how to bake bread, especially whole wheat bread. And so he created himself, and the method he came up with, which has you make a sponge first that you rise part of the dough, and then you add the rest of the flour and your oil and your salt. After that, is so reliable, and the recipe is so good that the book became a bestseller.
And you still make it to this day?
I do. Yeah, I've made it a couple times, you know, for readings, and it's just such delicious, rich, hearty bread. It has, you know, it's so much better than some of the other recipes that were out there back then.
So, who brought us tofu and soybean awareness? Who were the major players?
So, the two people I think who were the most involved in bringing a lot of Americans to tofu, you know, beyond sort of the West Coast where we've had Chinese and Japanese American communities making tofu. tofu for 150 years. The first person was Frances Morlope, who wrote Diet for a Small Planet. And she was living in Berkeley in the late 60s and early 70s, and she was really concerned about global famine. And so she set out to find out, you know, is global famine endemic? And she looked at agricultural reports and nutritional reports and came to the conclusion that if we stopped feeding if America stopped feeding all of the grain and soybeans that we were feeding to animals to make meat and fed them to humans instead, we could solve global famine. And so this book came, you know, Diet for a Small Planet came out, and it inspired hundreds of thousands, if not millions, mm-hmm. of people to be vegetarian. But it also focused on the soybean because, you know, for her, the soybean was kind of the perfect plant protein. Mm-hmm. And a young Zen monk who had actually been Ed Brown's roommate at Tassajara, named Bill Shurtleff, he and his girlfriend Akiko Ayagi were living in Tokyo at the time. And he read the Diet for a Small Planet and was like, oh, well, the tofu I'm eating actually could be something that people all around the world could make. It could be this readily available nutritional protein source. And so he and Akiko did research, wrote the Book of Tofu and the Book of Miso, and then went on a road trip around America. And they everywhere they stopped, he says, a tofu collective started up.
And then, of course, the farm in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the farm in Tennessee was a group of San Franciscans led by Stephen Gaskin.
I went to some of his lectures in San Francisco.
Oh, really? Part of the Sunday or Monday?
Yeah, yeah, the 1,500 people uh-huh. there. And he would rant and rave. And he was crazy.
but he influenced a lot
yes,
of people.
He did.
And
yeah.
he brought tempeh to the masses. Yeah. I think he was pretty
That's
important
right.
in that.
Yeah, they were when they moved to Tennessee and became the biggest rural commune in America, they were vegan. Mm-hmm. And so they had to figure mm-hmm. out how to feed themselves. And tempeh was this kind of substance they figured out how to make.
Back to the Landers and the organic farming is chapter number 5. A wonderful chapter about the rise of organic farming and organizations that started. Can you encapsulate how that happened?
Yeah, organics had been sort of around in America. J.I. Rodale, who published Organic Farming and Gardening, started about in 1940. He'd mm-hmm. introduced the word organic to America. But it was sort of, you know, and it had a decent circulation, but it was a very, very much a fringe movement until the Back to the Landers took off from the cities and moved to these rural areas in record numbers, and with them, these young kids took their ideas about, you know, wanting whole foods, natural foods, and wanting to farm without chemicals, and they really created the organic. They really gave it this sort of this huge boost, and then gave it an infrastructure to distribute and an audience to eat all of this organically grown food that made it, you know, form the backbone of the organic movement today.
So this was also the birth of, well, any number of publications, but the two that you mentioned in the book, at least two that you mentioned in the book, are the Whole Earth Catalog, mm-hmm. Which everybody subscribed to because you just had to have it. Mm-hmm. God knows what if you lived in the city, what you would ever do with that
right.
stuff. And the Mother Earth News, which was the other one, which I was a faithful subscriber
to. And East West Journal. Did you have East
yeah,
Coast Journal?
That was a macrobiotic.
I had that. I subscribed to that one.
It was, you know, I will say honestly that the whole, I tried the macrobiotic thing. It was just too severe. I couldn't do it.
Well, you're too much of a sensualist.
Maybe. It didn't always taste so good.
No, that's true too. There was a learning curve involved. Yeah. We'll come back and we'll get to chapter 6, 7 and the conclusion with Jonathan Kaufman. Hippie Food is the new book. It's how Back to the Landers, Longhairs, and Revolutionaries changed the way we eat. Jonathan Kaufman wrote it. He is a columnist, restaurant reviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Has anyone taken you to task yet? Has anyone said, well, your memories are wrong, and that's not really how it was, and it was a lot more severe. And
no, not yet.
No one has.
Not yet.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Do you have some? Do you have some constructive criticism?
No, I really don't. I early on, it was very bland, and I thought severe. The foods that I was eating,
yeah.
I tried to improve them, but I didn't have enough knowledge to really know. It was just pretty much rice every day and some veggies, and it was almost like an ascetic diet. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of pleasure, I guess, is what I'm saying.
No, there really wasn't.
I didn't really know about seasoning and sauces and how to, I didn't have any technique. Mm-hmm. I had not studied cooking at all. I just knew that I wanted to change my diet. It was more a political statement against cruelty and but not really very successful as far as an aesthetically pleasing.
The only thing I would offer, and you talk about it, is this was also that early 70s, a time in which we had all these extraordinary cookbooks about the cuisines, other cultures, and the food that was there, which was so delicious. And that at some point, there came a blending of those two things, this bland kind of vegetarian food with all of these amazing flavors from other.
Yeah, I didn't know about the Time Life cookbook series. Now I have the entire set, but it wasn't until 15 years later into the 80s that I even knew that existed.
Isn't it? I forgot that it started in 1968. That was the first publication in that series, which is great.
We'll be back after this.
North Bay play-by-play home of the Golden State Warriors and Oakland Raiders. FM News Talk Radio 103.5, 94.5, KSRO.
When you think of Sonoma County lifestyle, you think of amazing people and amazing local food and wine. Sonoma County restaurants employ over 18,000 people. And because there's an emphasis on farm fresh food and wine, this industry also supports local agriculture. To celebrate this vital industry, the Sonoma County Economic Development Board brings you the 9th annual Sonoma County Restaurant Week, now through Sunday, March 11th. Restaurant Week has expanded to 10 delicious days featuring 150 restaurants. Participating restaurants are offering specially priced three-course dinners at $19, $29, and $39. Some restaurants will offer a unique two-course lunch menu for only $10 or $15. To find out more, go to SonomaCounty.com and click Restaurant Week. For a chance to win gift cards valued up to $100, check out this radio station's website and share photos on Restaurant Week's Facebook page. Join us for 10 days of delicious dining during Sonoma County Restaurant Week, March 2nd through the 11th. Fun and cheese just go together. It's 3 days of cheese bliss at the 12th annual California Artisan Cheese Festival at the Sonoma County Fairgrounds in Santa Rosa, March 23rd through the 25th. On Friday, join 20 chefs and 20 rock star cheesemongers as they duel to see who will make the best bite. Learn from the experts at the Saturday seminars and pairing demos. Backed by popular demand on Saturday night, it's cheese and cocktails. The perfect opportunity for you to choose your favorite cheese and spirit pairing. Start your Sunday with a multi-course bubbles brunch, then stroll through the artisan cheese tasting and marketplace where you can meet more than 25 cheesemakers. Buy and taste all things that go great with cheese, like wine, beer, ciders, jams, jellies, crackers, chocolate, and so much more from over 100 artisan producers. It's Cheese, Cheese, and More Cheese, March 23rd through 25th at our new location, the Sonoma County Fairgrounds in Santa Rosa. Tickets will sell out, so get yours now at artisancheesefestival.com. That's artisancheesefestival.com.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
Sunshine came softly through my window today. Could have tripped out easy, but I've changed my way. It'll take time, I know it.
There's a little bit of Donovan for you to welcome us back to Jonathan Kaufman's new book, Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Longhairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. Steve Garner and John Ash in the Chaos Arto Kitchen. We've kind of worked our way into vegetarians and the curry trail. Describe that chapter.
So when you look at vegetarian cookbooks in particular, but you know, health food cookbooks in the 1960s and maybe up to 1970, they really were bland. Even the macrobiotic food, everything was very bland, very brown, very hearty. And I think it was because, you know, you have all these kids who are adopting all these ingredients, they don't know how to cook, and so where do they turn in their desperation but the sort of this newfound sense of travel? And so air travel became so much cheaper in 1960, and so a lot of it became, for middle class kids, going to Europe became something that they could do in the summer. It almost a rite of passage. And some of them even went farther. They went from, you know, they would get to Amsterdam and then take the overland route, the Curry Trail or the Hippie Trail, mm-hmm. all the way through Iran and Afghanistan to India. And so this curiosity about the flavors that were from of Asia and Central America and Eastern Europe kind of came back with them, even if specific dishes didn't, you know. And it was the way they found to make all of this new food taste so much better.
So travel had a major influence on the evolution of this food.
Yeah,
there were also again books at that time that came out, and one that I'm still very fond of is Anna Thomas's book, yeah. Which is, you know, which distilled flavors from everywhere, you know, and not in a kind of preachy sort of way, but, you know, that it's really fun to cook.
So yeah, Anna Thomas's Vegetarian Epicure, yeah. It came out in 1971, mm-hmm. and it was the first cookbook I have seen, you know, historically, first vegetarian cookbook to look at vegetarian food from a point of pleasure mm-hmm. only. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of her recipes were like, you know, had buckets of cream and cheese and, you know, and eggs. They were very, very rich because she was reading Gourmet Magazine and Julia Child, as, you know, as well as Indian mm-hmm. cookbooks, and to create her recipes. But it gave people the sense of a pleasure, you know. And it's funny, I just had lunch with her last week.
Did you?
LA. Oh, she's fantastic. Great.
She's great. She came up from Ohio and did the show with us about a year or so ago.
Oh, fantastic.
She's a wonderful person. And then, of course, 4 or 5 years later, the landmark, the bombshell exploded, Moosewood Cookbook,
yeah.
which I guess is still the best-selling vegetarian cookbook.
Yeah, it's one of the best-selling cookbooks of all time.
And what did Molly Katzman, how did she change?
So Molly Katzman and you know, the Moosewood Cookbook and collective in general, they were, Molly Katzman had been an art institute student who came out here and worked for a restaurant in San Francisco that some people may remember called Shandy Gaff, that was the hipster restaurant of its time. It served healthy food, but also things like fresh pesto and yogurt, you know, with granola on it. And she moved out with her brother to Ithaca, and mm-hmm. and a collective of them founded a restaurant. And they brought that love of travel and that curiosity about mm-hmm. all the cookbooks. They did a lot of research, you know, in the libraries at Cornell, and came up with this vegetarian food that was really globally inspired. You could have, you know, and when they came up with the cookbook, when she kind of wrote it all down into a cookbook, you know, you'd have a Bulgarian recipe next to an Indian recipe next yeah. to hummus next to enchiladas.
Mm-hmm. She did it all. Mm-hmm. And the final chapter is Food Co-ops, Social Revolutionaries, and the Birth of an Industry. And this encapsulates everything with the Austin food scene exploding and 1980. Really, everything changed.
Yeah. So, Austin, each chapter sort of takes part in a different part of the country, because I really wanted to give people a sense that, you know, if I was eating this food in Indiana in 1975, that people were really eating it all over. But Austin was a little like Minneapolis and the Bay Area in that it had this co-op scene that was so much larger than a food co-op. They had all these collectively run enterprises that were then married together in this network, this collective network. So they had like a garage and a farm and a school and, you know, a couple of co-ops. But, you know, that those co-ops, they were fueled by volunteer labor and by idealism and the idea that food is for profit, food for people, not for profit, mm-hmm. Which made them incredibly successful. It made it possible for them to spring up all over the country and bring all of these new foods and these ideas about food all over the, you know, to all across the country. But they were also run with a lot of financial naivete. And so they exploded as well. And picking Wheatsville Co-op, which was the co-op that emerged in Austin after several others failed pretty spectacularly, inspired a young group of entrepreneurs who wanted a for-profit grocery store called Whole Foods. They founded in 1980 that would bring all of these, you know, sort of crunchy natural foods together with gourmet, the idea of gourmet foods, and a really sort of middle-class bourgeois shopping experience. And it proved incredibly successful, as we all know.
Billions of dollars later.
Mm-hmm. Billions of dollars.
And that's after, and I'll tell you, if you don't read, if you get the book and you just want to read a great chapter. The conclusion is spectacular. I really enjoyed how you encapsulated everything in the book about where things were to where you see things going. It's a beautiful chapter.
Thanks.
Where do you see things going? What's the next evolution besides Amazon? If we were having this conversation in 10 years later, if you're sitting here.
Well, I will say the critique that emerged in the 1970s of an industrialized food is still just as trenchant today as it was back then. This idea that the fears that we had about pesticides and pesticides and chemical fertilizers and the mechanization of food and this globalized food supply and the fact that all of our food is processed. I mean, just the revolution, the hippie food revolution, didn't stop any of these things, but it did create an alternate pathway. And the organic industry is, hugely successful, and natural foods are around. And, to me, it's my hope that it will continue to grow and expand.
One of the comments that you made, it was a very, very brief one in this conclusion section, was that the 1970s kind of counterculture did succeed in selling America on its concept of healthy foods, which is there today, maybe more than it was then.
Yeah. Well, when you look at the nutritional books and comments in 1970, where you have Harvard nutritionists trying to bring down the natural food movement and saying things like, organic, our chemicals are our friend, and all chemicals are organic. And then you look at really, what the USDA guidelines tell us to eat. It's hippie food. Mm-hmm.
The last line of the book, do you know it, the quote?
I don't remember.
when brown rice reminds us all of our childhoods, then the hippie food revolution will finally be won. It's a beautiful line to conclude the book. Would you give us your favorite number today between 1 and 12?
9.
Caller number 9 at 636-1350 will win this autographed copy of Hippie Food by Jonathan Kaufman. Caller number 9 at 636-1350. Thank you for coming to Santa Rosa today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure meeting you.
It's a delight.
And I love the book and love reading your writings in the San Francisco Chronicle, too.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to the paperback. And then do you have another book fomenting?
Oh, who knows? Who knows?
Thank you, John Ash. We'll see you next week for St. Patrick's Day. I'll bring the corned beef, you bring the cabbage.
Cabbage, okay, that's
okay.
Good.
Okay, following that next, Clark Wolf at the table. That's after the news at noon. This is KSRO Santa Rosa. I'm Steve Garner. See you next week.
Hello, Sonoma County. I'm Digital Pro Kim Commando, and I'm here Sundays, noon to 3, on KSRO.
It's crab feed season at the Tides Wharf Restaurant in Bodega Bay, sitting right on the water with gorgeous views of the bay. The Tides Wharf Restaurant serves fresh, local seafood and American cuisine year-round. Now through March, their popular crab feeds are back with fresh-caught chilled crab, their famous clam chowder, pasta, salad, and French bread.
Served from 5 to 9 p.m., reservations are recommended. $59.95 gets you fresh crab, clam chowder, and all the fixins, including the Tide's famous mustard sauce. Call the Tide's Wharf Restaurant at 875-3652 or go online to inatthetides.com. Make a weekend of it and book a room. Special room rates for the crab feed guests. Each room at the Inn at the Tides has a view of the bay, and some also feature a fireplace. Get your reservation now for the Tides Wharf Restaurant Crab Feeds, only available twice each month through March, so call now, 875-3652, or online at inatthetides.com.